Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and at 13 hours GMT on Thursday, the 27th of June, these are our main stories. The BBC speaks to a people smuggler organising illegal boat crossings between France and the UK. Bolivia's opposition says the attempted military coup on Wednesday was staged by the president. And Denmark introduces the world's first tax on cows. Also in this podcast,
talk about a nothing burger. He would just be a vanilla. Just a vanilla old rich guy.
Those jostling for position to be chosen as Donald Trump's running mate. Thousands of migrants drown every year when their vessels capsize and sink, particularly in places like the Mediterranean and the North Atlantic. Well, the network of sea routes is spreading because there's growing demand and more people realise they can make money out of providing the service. Those are the people smugglers, and they've developed a hugely profitable business in the English Channel. That's the narrow stretch of water between France and the UK. Large numbers of migrants are crowded onto small inflatable boats that are often barely above the waterline. The BBC has tracked down and confronted a people smuggler thought to be responsible for organising a boat crossing in April, in which a seven-year-old girl died. Our Paris correspondent Andrew Harding was on the beach in France during that initial incident and, in a lengthy investigation, pursued the smuggler across Europe.
Excuse me, sir. Andrew Harding from BBC News.
I'm running through a public square in Luxembourg to confront a man we've been chasing across Europe.
We know who you are. You're a smuggler.
No.
We know he's responsible for putting hundreds of people in small boats heading from France to England. And responsible for one boat in particular. It was back in April, before dawn, on a beach in northern France. We witnessed police battling with a group of smugglers and chaos as two groups of people charged onto a small boat heading for the UK. Then we saw a girl in a pink coat being carried on board and later disappearing into the scrum. She suffocated soon afterwards. Four others on the boat also died. The girl's name was Sarah, 7 years old, born in Belgium, raised in Sweden. A few days later, still in the French port of Wimmera, we found her father, Ahmed, an Iraqi man, consumed by grief and also by guilt. But what of those who actually organised the family's trip? Not the foot soldiers on the beaches, but the generals working behind the scenes. We hear the man who arranged Sarah's deadly journey is still active, still smuggling. To find him, we have to leave France.
Three sources who've all dealt directly with the same smuggling boss have told us confidentially that we'll find our smuggler in the Belgian city of Antwerp, so that's where we're heading now. Our plan is for one of our team, we're calling him Mahmoud to protect his identity, to pose as a migrant. We are now waiting for the smuggler to call us. He's just sent us a text message. So it could be any moment now.
Believing he's talking to a potential client, he offers Mahmoud a seat on his next boat.
You want to get to Britain? Are you ready or not? How many seats do you need? It's safe. 100%.
It is crucial confirmation that the smuggler is still in business. Separately, a source has provided us with more information, pictures of the smuggler and his identity papers. His name is Rebwa, 39 years old, with an Iraqi passport.
So it turns out he's not in Belgium anymore. Worried about being arrested, he's on the run. And we're in pursuit.
Screen grabs and videos sent to us from the smuggler's phone indicate that he's in some sort of camp, which we've matched online to a migrant and asylum seeker reception centre in Luxembourg.
So he's answering the phone. We know that this is you, sir. We know 100% that you are a smuggler, that you are responsible for the death of this seven-year-old, that you put her on a boat, that you took money from her parents, that she and four other people died. That's you. We know this is our man. He's getting on a tram now. We're going to let him go. There's not much more we can do.
As for the family Sarah left behind, they're being housed temporarily in a small village in France. But this grieving family has no permission to settle anywhere in Europe. Instead, they wait in limbo while the smuggling industry thrives.
Andrew Harding on the trail of people smugglers. To Bolivia now, a nation with a long history of political instability. There have been 190 or so coups since independence. That's an average of nearly one a year. After the latest attempt, or irregular mobilisation of troops, as the government put it, the defence minister says the government is now back in total control of the armed forces. The former armed forces commander, General Juan José Zuniga, is now in custody after deploying hundreds of soldiers and armed vehicles in the centre of the main city, La Paz. Speaking after order was restored, the president, Luis Arce, thanked Bolivians for their loyalty.
Han querido sorprendernos y sorprender al pueblo boliviano.
They wanted to surprise us and the Bolivian people. We have reacted. And also the people have mobilised against this coup attempt. Thanks to the Bolivian people.
Gracias, pueblo boliviano!
But the opposition in Bolivia has already called this a self-coup, a staged, managed, fake coup. Their ledge was organised by President Arce. Andrea Barrientos is an opposition senator. She spoke to us from the city of Cochabamba.
What happened today in Bolivia, it's really bizarre situation. I can say that we can affirm that it was a self-coup organized by Luis Arce's government. Around 1:30 p.m., there was a lot of military. And if you are going to have a coup, you cannot have a minister, a government minister that rules the police, just walking around militaries. Also, Zuniga said later today that it was a president order that he was following to take the tanks to the palace.
I asked Ana Maria Rura from BBC Mundo what seems to have been going on.
Well, at this moment, everything is very confusing. What we can confirm is that we know that General Juan José Zuniga was one of the closest persons in the army to the president, Luis Arce, but he is now responsible for this attempt of coup d'etat, and he's investigated at leading this very, we can say, fast and confusing coup attempt. Right after, a small faction of the army that was led by him was trying to get inside of the former president palace, the Palacio Quemado, he said that he was trying to restructure democracy in the country. We also know that Zuniga had been dismissed ahead of the Bolivian army on Tuesday for threatening statements against the former president Evo Morales. And after his arrest, we heard that the general saying to the press he had a meeting with the president Arce on Sunday. And I quote, he said, "The president told me the situation was bad and this week would be critical. Then it was needed to prepare something to push up his popularity. And I asked him," he said, "shall we take the armored vehicles out?" And he said, "take them out." That was the statement of the General Zuniga.
So just to clarify, what the opposition is saying, that this was orchestrated by the government, there is no credibility behind that as far as you can see.
We have two versions of what happened, and now everything is very confusing. We cannot confirm any of the two versions.
So how does this leave Mr. Arce now? Is he strengthened or weakened by this?
Well, we can say that after this episode, his popularity has boosted. And let's remember that he was living a very profound crisis, an economic crisis, and also an internal political crisis. But we have seen also yesterday how thousands of people just went in front of the presidential palace to defend democracy, they say, and to reject this attempt of coup d'etat.
Ana Maria Rura from BBC Mundo. In a matter of hours, the rematch will start as Joe Biden and Donald Trump go head-to-head in their first election debate. The two men, who have a combined age of 159, are the candidates to compete for America's top job. But one thing that still remains a bit of a mystery is who Donald Trump would pick as his running mate. Our correspondent Neda Torfik takes a look at the top contenders.
We need Donald Trump!
Donald J. Trump will make America great again. Thank
you. In what feels like the VP edition of The Apprentice, there's no shortage of contenders vying to be Donald Trump's running mate. Among the reported shortlist, a governor from the fourth least populous state of North Dakota, a black Southern Republican senator, a Cuban-American senator from Florida, a Trump country so-called intellectual populist, and a millennial congresswoman from New York.
Given his penchant for drama, I think his preference really is to keep people guessing.
Senator Kevin Cramer of North Dakota believes it's highly likely Trump will pick the governor of his state, Doug Burgum.
Who are we going to send back to the White House? Trump!
Like Trump, he entered politics in 2016 as a businessman. The wealthy governor made his fortune by mortgaging his family's farm to invest in a software company, which he later took public and sold to Microsoft for $1.1 billion in 2001.
He brings a stability, brings a knowledge of how to run a corporation, how to run a family farm, how to run a grain elevator. And I do think Doug's governing of the energy boom in North Dakota is very appealing to Donald Trump and to his message. And I do think that Doug Burgum balances some of the more impulse, if you will, and the big personality of Donald Trump.
So get ready for something, okay? Just get ready. But Doug Burgum has been incredible.
Myra Adams, a former Republican and an op-ed writer for the U.S. political website The Hill, also believes Burgum is the favorite to take it. Despite running in the Republican presidential primary, Governor Burgum doesn't have much of a national profile. She is betting that Trump wants someone photogenic who will staunchly defend him, but who will not outshine him.
Talk about a nothing burger. My little town has more people than North Dakota, but he doesn't present any kind of problem. He would just be a vanilla, just a vanilla old rich guy.
If Trump is more focused on a VP who could bring in additional votes, Myra is among those who say Senator Marco Rubio of Florida is the better choice.
He speaks Spanish. And that is so key. I can't emphasize that enough. This will be the first election where the Hispanic vote is projected to be larger than the black vote. Biden won 67% of Hispanic Catholics compared to 32% for Trump. Rubio could really help with Hispanic Catholics. Plus, Rubio is very experienced. He's vice chairman of the Intelligence Committee. But I don't think Trump trusts him. I think Trump believes that Rubio is just looking to be president.
Considered up with Burgum and Rubio in the top three is the new Ohio Senator J.D. Vance.
Let's rebuild prosperity for America's citizens and reelect Donald J. Trump.
He once wondered whether Trump was America's Hitler, but is now close to Trump's son, Don Jr. He is seen by some as more useful in Congress and unlikely to add much to the ticket. And what about a running mate that could help with key demographic groups that lean Democrat? Here's senior advisor to the Trump 2016 campaign, Dave Urban.
Do you think women who may be suspect of Donald Trump would somehow overcome their suspicion, be overcome by having just a woman on the ticket? And the same goes for having an African-American on the ticket. Again, wouldn't it be the ultimate irony that if the vice president were picked, somebody not on the list? Right? Wouldn't that be the ultimate showmanship?
Whoever it is would not only be a heartbeat away from the presidency should Trump win, but potentially the future leader of the party for years to come.
Neda Torfik. Earlier on in the podcast, we heard about that people smuggler. Well, now authorities have uncovered some particularly inventive and damaging new tactics employed by international animal smugglers. These include sending endangered frogs by post and trafficking rhino horns by grinding them into a paste. Our environment correspondent Navin Singhkadka, tell me more.
So see, for example, just last March, authorities in Vietnam, for instance, for the first time, they caught a shipment which was covered by something painted black. and there was a cover load of cow horns. But then, upon closer examination, they found that it was actually ivories painted in black and mixed up with cow horns. And they say that was by chance it happened. And as you mentioned, postal services, you know, courier services, all these toys stacked in the toys, first in within socks and then in the thing. And also, interestingly, some academic studies have also shown that these traffickers are now using smell, you know, like, for example, spices in certain contrabands, illegal wildlife goods, to foil the detection capacity of dogs, sniffer dogs at airports. For example, you know, you've got ivories or rhino horns or pangolin scales. Recently, there was a case where they caught one pangolin scale, a basket, mixed up with mahogany seeds. And the smell was the deterrence. So this kind of thing, and it's always evolving.
Yeah, as you say, always evolving. They're constantly trying to keep one step ahead of the authorities. The authorities are obviously forcing them into using new tactics. And there are successes, aren't there, in the fight against animal smugglers?
There are some successes. That's why all these examples came into light. Otherwise, we wouldn't have known them. But the thing is, what I'm being told by these different authorities is resource is one thing, that they do not have enough resource or even training. And then come to think of it, one tactic what traffickers use is mix up legal and illegal goods. For example, timber. You see, there are timber that are allowed for legally, you know, trading. That's allowed. But then what they do is they mix them up with illegal ones, happening in Europe as well. So what happens is, imagine hundreds of containers. Airport officials tell me it's impossible to check all of them. And that is a big task.
Navin Sinkatka. Still to come.
Ultimately, this is something that, you know, potentially is opening a door to saying, well, we're going to replace you forever.
The new AI tool that threatens to shake up the world of music. Voters will go to the polls a week today in Britain's general election. They'll be doing so at a time of record levels of distrust in both politicians and the system as a whole. Although a lack of faith in politics is hardly unique to Britain, among developed countries, it appears to be even worse in the UK than in its European neighbours. This report from our British political correspondent, Rob Watson.
Welcome to Hull, a once very prosperous port city in the northeast of England, now more down on its luck, and where in 2019 fewer than 50% of people bothered to vote at the last general election, the lowest turnout anywhere in Britain. I've come to ask people what they think of politics and politicians.
Democracy as it stands is a joke. It's a four-year lottery between two parties. And Parliament is a farce as well. It's like old-fashioned Oxford debating society. It's just not fit for purpose anymore.
We all went through COVID thinking that, you know, we were doing the right thing and nobody could see loved ones and things like that. And they were blatantly doing what they wanted to do. Sticks in my throat very much. I think they're all the most selfish bunch going. Whatever party you vote for, I don't trust any of them.
They're just corrupt because they're all wealthy and they don't care about us. And we're at the bottom of the pile.
Is there anything that politicians could do to, I don't know, restore your trust and confidence?
Visit the area and try and live a life as a normal person.
So how typical are the residents of Hull in being fed up and disillusioned with politics and politicians? I'm with Sophie Stowers of the UK and a Changing Europe programme at King's College London and author of a recent paper on apathy in Britain and how it compares to other European countries. So, Sophie, how typical is it?
I mean, we know it's very typical. A majority of the public distrust politicians, but also there's also that doubt about just their fundamental ability to do the job. Realistically, our voters just don't think politicians are very good, to be blunt. What's interesting is how that translates into turnout. We know that certain groups are just simply less likely to turn out, so we know that younger voters, people who haven't been to university, people from more deprived backgrounds, ethnic minority voters too, are all less likely to actually turn out in the polls. So even though the apathy is widespread, it only affects turnout for a more specific group of voters.
If there is no doubt about the historic levels of apathy and anger here, who is to blame and what can be done?
Charles Walker is standing down at this election after 20 years as a Conservative MP. He's one of those rare politicians in that he is liked and respected across the political spectrum. Have I made you blush a bit, Charles?
You have. It's not about apportioning blame, though, as to why there are levels of apathy. It's trying to understand why. And I suspect there are high levels of apathy because for the past 16 years, the economy hasn't grown particularly fast and people are feeling worse off and they're feeling grumpy at politicians. And I think when people are feeling grumpy, you see some drift off to the fringes, to the right and left, and others just withdraw their vote. And right now, I think a lot of people feel that they're just walking through very heavy mud.
You've been a politician for 20 years. I mean, does this anger sort of bother you? I mean, worry you?
All anger bothers me and worries me, but when people get angry, they look for simple solutions to complex questions. And that's when you get into demagoguery. And as we see in Russia, that doesn't work out so well, does it? And at least we have the right to be apathetic in this country.
Conservative politician Charles Walker ending that report by Rob Watson. Now, is the Islamic State group making a comeback? At the height of its powers in 2015, it imposed a real reign of terror over millions of people and controlled large areas of Iraq and Syria, from which it launched attacks in the region and beyond. Over the last few years, IS has been operating in the shadows since it was largely crushed by a US-led coalition. But in March, gunmen stormed a concert in Moscow, killing 145 people and injuring more than 500 others. Islamic State said four of its members carried out that attack. Officials in Berlin at the Euro 24 football championships have warned that there could be similar attacks on the scale of Moscow there. The former head of the British intelligence services, MI6, Alex Younger, and the co-director of the Centre on Armed Groups, Ashley Jackson, have been giving their thoughts about the re-emergence of IS to Nick Robinson.
It's showing signs of resurgence, but it's not as dangerous as it was in 2016. And there are three key areas that we've really got to keep an eye on. The first is Syria. So there are a set of refugee camps and prisoner of war camps where the Kurds are holding the fighters taken prisoner after the war against Daesh, against ISIS. They're still there. They're powder kegs for radicalisation. The resources are limited, the money's limited. This problem has not gone away. And if those camps go the wrong way, we've all got a problem. So we need to keep our eye on that. Secondly, we've got a really teasing my enemy's enemy is my friend problem in Afghanistan. Actually, on this one, the Taliban's on our side. Now, they're a medieval pariah state, which, and rightly so, given their treatment of women. But we need to find a way to incentivize them to further intensify their work against ISIS. There's a vicious war going on between the two. And that puts us on the same side as some awkward bedfellows. And thirdly, in the same context, Daesh don't pose an international threat to the extent that they did because they don't really have a base. But they are building one now in Tajikistan, a failing state beset by poverty and authoritarianism. That's why Iran and Russia are being attacked. Daesh is reconstituting and has taken leadership in Tajikistan. And we've got to work on that. And that means something that puts us on the same side as Russia and Iran. It's complicated.
These are complicated policy choices. We'll come back to them in just a second. Let me get the perspective first of Ashley Jackson about Daesh. That's the French name, isn't it? Often used for ISIS. It's interchangeable in the conversations that we have about this.
Well, I can't speak specifically to Syria, but I would sort of add to what Sir Alex said, and that's that not all ISIS fighters, not all Islamic State fighters or sympathizers are locked up in camps, right? And a lot of the networks that helped facilitate finances, ideology, communications, they still kind of exist in different pockets in Central Asia, in Pakistan, Turkey, elsewhere. And more than that, a lot of the attacks that we see now are not Islamic State fighters. It's these sort of do-it-yourself kind of attacks where small groups or individuals can act really autonomously using the Islamic State banner. And then the Islamic State claims credit and grabs headlines after the fact. And those attacks keep the Islamic State alive, and that's what matters. As long as they can grab headlines and stay alive as this idea which inspires action for people who are sort of dissatisfied or disgruntled or marginalized,
Sir Alex,
there is a chance.
You've used a striking phrase to describe this sort of do-it-yourself, the kind of Nike approach to terrorism.
Yeah, so this is just do it. And I think ISIS are less able to mount complex attacks, thankfully, than they were of the sort we saw in Paris. But as Ashley's saying, they propagate a very effective and powerful single narrative online, and they call on individuals spontaneously to mount attacks. Just do it. The significance of that is, in some ways, it's less dangerous, but it's much, much more difficult to track.
Ashley, would you address Sir Alex's point that in the region that I know you particularly study, Afghanistan and Pakistan, that we may have to do a deal, in inverted commas, with the devil, with the Taliban, to take on ISIS?
Well, the Islamic State had this resurgence in 2022 after the Taliban takeover. But the Taliban, as Sir Alex has rightly pointed out, has cracked down. And what we see in Afghanistan, Pakistan, is the Islamic State is basically, you know, really suppressed. But as in Europe, as in Syria, Iraq, it's still an idea. Where there's space to operate, it's taking that space. It exists as this kind of looming threat, but it does mean cooperating with governments where there have been these pockets. It does mean having a different kind of global approach.
Ashley Jackson, and before her, we heard Alex Younger. In Denmark, from 2030, livestock farmers will be taxed for the greenhouse gases emitted by their cows, sheep and pigs. It will be the first country to do so, as it targets a major source of methane emissions. The BBC's David Lewis talked me through what was going on.
So what images, Nick, spring to mind when you consider the world's most polluting industries? There's gas-guzzling air travel, shipping's got a pretty whopping carbon footprint too. You might be forgiven for not thinking immediately, and Nick, I don't mean this to sound too indelicate, flatulent farmyard animals. But the Danes, at least, are stealing a march on methane. The Copenhagen government is on a mission to drastically slash emissions. And their strategy? Well, it's tax, and it's agricultural workers who'll be paying. Christian Fromberg from Greenpeace in Denmark says there wasn't much of an option.
The problem with our livestock emissions in Denmark is actually huge. So by 2030, the agriculture will stand for around 50% of Danish emissions. So there is really no bigger problem in Denmark than our current agricultural system. So that is also why we have come to this tipping point where now we are actually getting this carbon tax.
And it could be a vital strategy. Gases released from the burps and backsides of barnyard animals account for about 32% of human-caused methane emissions. So says the United Nations Environment Programme. The gas traps even more heat than carbon dioxide, a major contributor to global warming and current climate change trends.
So, David, how's the tax going to work?
Well, as of 2030, Danish livestock farmers will pay a levy of about $50 per tonne of emissions. Now, a typical cow in Denmark produces 6 metric tons of CO2 equivalent per year. And as a major dairy and meat exporter, there's almost 1.5 million head of cattle in the country. So the pollution and tariffs tot up. Taxes raised will go towards reforestation and other domestic green initiatives. The Danes have set a target of becoming carbon neutral by 2045. And despite the financial pressure this might put on farmers, have called for other countries to follow suit.
David Lewis. We end the podcast with artificial intelligence, which has certainly ruffled a few feathers of late in the world of music. Pioneering artists who may once have embraced cutting-edge technology sounded the alarm last year. That's over YouTube's new tool that can generate songs with apparent ease. YouTube has reportedly tried to calm the storm by offering cash upfront to record labels so it can make use of their music to train the tool. But will it be enough to convince the big stars? Amal Rajan has been hearing reaction to this from George Fitzgerald, a DJ and electronic musician and producer.
I have to say I'm struggling to see the positive in this, I'm afraid, for musicians. I obviously I'm seeing this strictly from a musician's point of view and from a creative point of view. And this just looks like a pretty dystopian scenario for musicians. And it's something that I really hope that the major labels and other labels would resist, to be honest. I don't want to seem like a Luddite here. It's not lost on me that people called synthesizers nearly 100 years ago illegitimate instruments and thought that they were going to replace humans. But this really does feel like a different scenario. You're not just replacing primary artists almost, you're replacing
all of the secondary people in music who work behind the scenes, recording engineers, producers, studio technicians, everything you're talking about, completely wiping out an infrastructure. And it just sort of feels like something that seems like a good idea in a Silicon Valley boardroom, to be honest, to sort of get rid of inefficient and expensive inconvenience that musicians represent.
It is the case. I mean, people have often said that artificial intelligence, you know, there is a kind of dystopian idea that in the end it could replace humans. This is quite literally the industry of music suggesting an efficient way of actually doing that, isn't it? It's actually using trained artificial intelligence to create sounds, productions that would, in effect, in a much more efficient technological way, do what is currently done by, as you say, a whole world of musicians and creatives and engineers.
Absolutely. And we're already there in the sense that there is a lot of AI already happening within music. I mean, behind the scenes, in a technical sense, there's a lot of things being marketed as AI that use similar processes that are helping us make the music quicker. But the human is the ultimate arbiter in this. There's a human at the end of it. And this is the first thing I've seen, really, apart from the Suno and Udio services, which are still sort of at the ChatGPT level of being good but not convincing. Ultimately, this is something that, you know, potentially is opening a door to saying, well, we're going to replace you forever. I have some reservations about whether humans themselves are ultimately going to want to listen to this music in replacement, in lieu of actual human made music. But they're talking about a one-off payment as well, which just feels a little bit like, if you let YouTube do this, then the horse has bolted forever.
DJ, electronic musician and producer George Fitzgerald. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Jack Wilfen and the producer was Alfie Habersham. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye.